KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we talk in the first half hour about a possible pending agreement in Iraq for a U.S. pullout of troops. And in our second half hour, we discuss the recent resignation as CEO of Yahoo founder and head Jerry Yang, what it means for the future of that Sunnyvale company. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Monday, the 275-seat Iraqi parliament began considering an agreement that will determine the future of U.S. forces there. If approved, it would set a timetable of December 31, 2011, as the final date for U.S. occupation troops to leave Iraq, the date that marks the expiration of the U.N. mandate. Prime Minister Maliki and his cabinet approved the agreement over the weekend, and debate will be going on this week with a vote anticipated on November 25th for what has resulted from negotiations that have lasted almost a year. There was a signing ceremony on Monday, and today pushing and shoving broke out in the Iraqi parliament during discussions. In this opening forum segment, we want to explore what this agreement will mean for the U.S. and Iraq and the region. Joining us from Stanford is Thomas Hendrickson. He is senior fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of American Power After the Berlin Wall, a review of post-Cold War foreign policies. And welcome, Tom Hendrickson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Also say good morning to Stephen Zunis, who is professor of politics and international studies at University of San Francisco, author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, Middle East editor also at Foreign Policy in Focus. He's with us this morning from Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana. And welcome, Steve Zunis.
Good morning.
Morning to you. Actually, Earlham College, I believe, is where your daughter is as a college student. And I mention that only because you wrote a letter to her, which was a very actually moving letter about all of the years from your perspective that she had witnessed your sort of taking on as a scholar and as an analyst the Iraqi conflict. And it would appear, at least now, that maybe it's time you can tell your daughter it's actually winding down?
I hope so, but I'm not confident. There are enough ambiguities in the proposed Status of Forces Agreement that we'll probably be discussing later that may mean U.S. involvement will be longer, and also the current balance of forces in Iraq, which has led to decreased violence in the past year or so, is something I think is pretty fragile, and I'm not confident that things might get bad again.
But there is, at least on paper, and if it passes through the Iraqi parliament, and as I said, there was actually today pushing and shoving, a timetable, something which at one time, certainly during the campaign, was anathema to many people who were let's say, particularly from the Republican side of you.
Yes, and I think both the United States and Iraq are recognizing that the ongoing presence of U.S. forces, particularly in the urban areas, particularly as long as they're engaging in offensive counterinsurgency population or operations, is becoming more of a hindrance to stability than an asset. And so I think there's a growing consensus that there needs to be some kind of timetable, but the details, of course, still need to be worked out.
Well, the devil is certainly in the details, and we'll talk about them. But Thomas Hendrickson, again, did you expect to see a timetable at this juncture? Is it really kind of the Pentagon saying, well, it's time for this because we're doing a transition into a new presidency?
Well, I think the Bush administration was adamantly against a timetable until very recently. And I think actually the election of a Barack Obama, that factor, and the fact that this was probably the best agreement, but it could be secured by the administration. Time is running out, as you indicated, on the UN mandate, and consequently, it's better to have some agreement than no agreement. I think the Bush administration wanted to turn over at least a seemingly orderly Iraq to a new administration. So under the circumstances, I think they accepted it.
It's going to look like a defeat, possibly, and certainly Al-Qaeda presumably will make it seem like it looks like a defeat, won't they?
Absolutely, and we can expect that. There will be more violence. The situation is, in fact, very fragile, and Al-Qaeda, some of the units have moved into northern Lebanon, but they can be returned, and Al-Qaeda will probably try to reap some sort of propaganda victory and will step up violence as this agreement takes hold, if it's passed, and takes hold, and we begin to pull out troops in the next year or so.
What do you see as the biggest obstacle? I mean, aside from the fact that there's a good deal of political opposition from Ahmed al-Sadr and some of the Sunni leaders, at this point, as we indicated with Stephen Zunis, and we'll hear him on this too, there's a lot of details that supposedly have been worked out, but there's ongoing concern, for example, over here about protecting U.S. soldiers.
Well, that's it. And there's some ambiguity about what to do with the 16,000 detainees. You know, the Sunnis want them released. So that's one factor. They're also, under the agreement, there's supposed to be a warrant issued by the Iraqi government before American soldiers make arrests. And that's sometimes, you know, whether the arrests happen first or whether it's just they take something happens and then later they have to sort of justify it and post-planning, so to speak. So there's those sorts of things to be done.
Well, a big fight ahead, Stephen Zunis, from your perspective, over extraterritorial rights.
Yeah, very much so. That there are, you know, the Americans obviously are concerned about the nascent Iraqi justice system, that the judiciary, like a number of branches of the Iraqi government, are dominated by, you know, at least parts of it are dominated by those of a more, you know, sectarian or, bend instead of, you know, a rule of law kind of orientation. So there's concern about Americans, both, you know, civilian contractors and military when they're off duty, finding themselves in the Iraqi court system. At the same time, one can understand why the Iraqis doesn't want a situation where they're courts don't have jurisdiction over crimes that are committed inside their country. I mean, obviously, Americans would be upset if we had, you know, foreigners who could get away with murder and or other serious crimes. And so, you know, both sides have some legitimate grievances in here, and it'll be very interesting, especially if this does go to the U.S. Congress, that, you know, the demands of the Iraqi parliamentarians and American members of Congress may be hard to reconcile.
What about the region? It's pretty clear that Iran and Syria are both in opposition to this agreement, yet you would think, at least from what we read from the Bush administration perspective, Iran and Syria would want the United States out and would want an agreement that would get the United States out.
Well, actually, what appears to happen is that both sides have gone from opposition to neutral just in the past couple of weeks, which may be a reason why this the cabinet was finally able to approve this, because Iran has a fair amount of influence over some some parties and individuals in the Iranian cabinet. And we're not talking about the Sadrists. I mean, a lot of people forget that Maliki's party.
Well, they're Shiite also. Yeah.
Oh yeah. But that, you know, the largest faction in the cabinet was a group that was used to be called SCIRI, Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They spent their exile years in Iran. They were recognized by Iran as the de facto Iraqi government in exile. The Badr Corps, their militia, was trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, even fought with Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. And so they still have quite a bit of influence on this and on this party. And they were largely responsible for blocking it up to this point, because they do wield a fair amount of influence inside the country. However, I think with the election of Obama, they are less concerned about the U.S. Forces remaining even for additional full 3 years in terms of being a launching pad to attack Iran. So they have gone from to opposing it to neutral, which I think is a large part what made it possible for the to get a near unanimous approval of the cabinet.
Well, at this point, Thomas Hendrickson, the two main blocs in the parliament, the Kurdish Alliance and the Shiite United Iraqi Alliance, say they have enough votes on their own to approve the whole deal by the required 51% majority. But the Iraqi government says they want a broad consensus for this deal. I don't know what a broad consensus means. Do you?
Well, I don't think so, but I think what they want is substantial Sunni participation. And one thing the agreement does do, and I think this is why Iran might be giving his blessing, is it actually has a provision in it that Iraq cannot be used as a base to attack other countries, and that implies, of course, Syria, but mostly Iran. So that, I think, has helped turn them into more neutral toward it, in addition to the election of Barack Obama.
What about Turkey? Certainly affected by this because of the substantial Kurdish population, and also Saudi Arabia, who sees their own interests in terms of Sunni interests in Iran, in Iraq. I mean, how do they figure into this whole equation? As you say?
Well, I think in the case of Turkey, much of their concern is a stable government, one they can deal with in order to stop the Kurdish attacks into Turkey itself, into the southeast corner. So I think a stability for them is better, a stronger government they can work with, and so that's one thing. The case of Saudi Arabia, I think it's somewhat of probably watchful waiting. They want to see the Sunnis' rights, as you indicated, guaranteed, and some sway within Iraq as well. So I think that they'd be cautiously waiting. But again, I think the agreement getting America out will diffuse some of the tensions in the region. At least if there's a prospect the United States is going to be leaving.
Let me open the phone lines because this segment is a half hour, and I know many of you want to weigh in here. Let us know what you think, your opinions, and so forth, but also have questions for either or both of our guests. And if you would like to join the program, you can do so now. It's live and it's interactive, and we welcome your phone calls. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's toll-free from wherever you're listening to Forum or however, on the radio, the internet, or the Sirius satellite. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email. And our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Thomas Hendrickson, who is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of American Power After the Berlin Wall, and with Stephen Zunis, who's professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. And once again, if the Iraqi government officials actually approve the newest version of this U.S.-Iraqi security agreement, American combat forces would leave Iraqi cities, towns, villages by next July, and all U.S. troops would be gone from the country by the 31st of December 2011. But Iraqi approval of the plan is really at this point anything but certain. And in fact, as I said, as of today, there was fighting and shoving that broke out within the Iraqi parliament. Actually, Stephen Zunis, you see this as a real split between sectarians and nationalists.
Yes, and in many cases, in many ways, the parliament is more nationalistic than the government itself, the cabinet itself. And so it's going to be tough to get a 50% plus one majority in the parliament, and it's going to be even more difficult given that there's a strong case that can be made, and a number of parliamentarians are making this, that this being a treaty needs to get a two-thirds majority. And that would be nearly impossible to achieve. There's a real, part of the concern also is there's some ambiguity in terms of how absolute the deadline is. For example, there's a clause that basically says that these changes have to be require written notice 1 year in advance. So if say Iraq wanted the United States out earlier, or Obama wanted to withdraw earlier, and the other side didn't agree, there would not be, and there's an argument that they would not be able to. So this ties both the President-elect Obama's hands as president, as well as the Iraqi government. And so then there's also concern about the that the United States will be able to conduct military operations continually without necessarily permission of the government. And that also, and another concern, which is going on the congressional side, is that there's also a provision there about a joint Iraqi-U.S. command, which places American troops conceivably under the command of a foreign armed forces. Now, that's not unreasonable in itself. We've done it before. But every other time we've done it before, it has been in the form of a treaty ratified by two-thirds of our Senate, and that's not how the Bush administration is putting this forward. So that would be an unprecedented issue that's going to bring concerns in our Congress as well. So, again, this is a situation where the legislative bodies of both sides, you know, have issues which may end up being contradictory.
One of those big issues, again, Thomas Hendrickson, is the idea of complete withdrawal. I'm sure that Barack Obama would like to move troops into Afghanistan. He's made that abundantly clear. But if Iraq moves into, well, the center not holding and some kind of civil war and things really begin particularly to take on a really, well, combative cast with al-Qaeda, it would seem likely that some kind of American presence would probably continue. So what are we talking about? We're talking about complete withdrawal here, really.
No, I don't think there'll be a complete withdrawal, no matter the deadline of 2011. I think there will always be some combat troops and some advisors in Iraq for the foreseeable future. Mainly, I think the Iraqis will probably want them there some. And I think what the idea is to get it down substantially, and whatever that substantially might be, but there'll be American troops in some form, I think, for quite some time.
Well, let me bring our callers into this, and Phil, join us. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. You know, everybody's talking about withdrawal, but, you know, Michael, you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs on your show, and in that show he was asked about, instead of a pullout, or a stay, a pullback, meaning U.S. forces. Now, I noticed that the wording of your guest said that U.S. forces would withdraw from villages and cities. And the standard thing to do in this kind of military situation is to pull back to the borders and control the borders, the border with Syria and the border with Iran, because that's the most likely way that this fragile peace will be kept. I'm interested what your guests have to say about that and whether they've heard any such plan from their friends in the military. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Thomas Hendrickson?
Well, I think it's part of the American military strategy currently to do what they call the indirect approach. And this is also used in, particularly in the Philippines, but it has been used in the Horn of Africa. That is to say, United States forces do not take the lead in combat operations, but they always work through an indigenous force. And that seems to be an evolving strategy in the military right now. As a consequence, within Iraq, yes, I think they'll stay there. And your caller's correct. I think they will stay in bases outside, try to be more less obtrusive.
At the borders, as he suggested?
At the borders. I mean, that was the Iraqi study group's idea. You recall back when that happened in late 2006, that they were talking about pulling back the borders and to protect the borders from infiltrators. So as a consequence, I think that makes a lot of sense, and that probably will happen at least for a while.
What do you think, Stephen Zunis?
Actually, I don't think the borders are as big an issue, and it's certainly not as much as they were at the time the Iraq Study Group gave their report. I mean, at that time, there were hundreds of foreign fighters infiltrating every month. Now there are, you know, maybe a couple dozen. It's gone, you know, the outside threat, which was never more than maybe 10% of the Iraqi resistance, is I think less of a factor. As is Al Qaeda, they've largely been defeated, but so if there's instability, things are going to become, you know, from within, breakdown of the ceasefire by the Sadrists. You know, the Sons of Iraq tribal groups get frustrated that they're not being included in the government, and they go back to fighting it. And I mean, there are a number of scenarios that may require an ongoing U.S. presence, but I don't think border security is that high. I mean, I think in terms of having a quick reaction strike or force or something like that, Obama and others have talked about that over the horizon approach they refer to. That could happen in bases in Jordan or Turkey or Kuwait. It doesn't necessarily have to be in Iraq. And while having bases in Iraq outside the cities is less provocative, I think for certain people, it may be too tempting a target. And when we think about Egypt, even when it ended its formal when the British ended their formal occupation of Egypt early in the 20th century, they maintained their bases there well into the 1950s, and they became targets for hit-and-run guerrilla attacks. And so So yes, so I agree there'll be a long-standing U.S. military presence, advisors, and occasional in-and-out commando operations if there's good intelligence of a terrorist cell. The Iraqis themselves are unable and willing to break up, but I think that the U.S. is going to try to get as many, if they're smart anyway, the Obama administration is going to try to get as many of the troops out as possible.
Let me get as many of our callers on as possible with the time remaining. Seth, hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I had two comments. It doesn't seem likely that we're going to withdraw, considering that we're building something on the order of 13 military bases there and a embassy larger than the Vatican in downtown Baghdad. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is that with the 700-plus military bases we have around the world, none of those do we have that sovereign nation having their laws be over any of the military personnel we have here. I mean, there have been numerous incidents in Okinawa where military personnel have broken laws and raped and murdered, and we've always pulled them back and judged them under our own court. So I'd appreciate some comments on both.
Okay, well, Tom Henderson, that's still a sticking point, isn't it?
The criminal jurisdiction, you mean,
yeah.
In a sense? Yes, it is a sticking point in how to do that. It does say that somebody agreement points to the fact that the United States troops, if they're off duty in downtown Baghdad and they commit a crime, that's clearly going to be in the hands of Iraqi. But there is a commission to kind of sort that out. So it's still a little ambiguous. And I think that's one of the problems with the agreement. There are some ambiguities, which everyone will pick up on, not the U.S. Congress and the Iraqi parliament itself.
Well, Stephen Zunis, here's Rick who sends the following email. You were saying that you thought Iran was moving more toward a neutral position, and Rick argues that Muqtada al-Sadr and his comrades in arms are objecting. He believes that his final moment, now that 6 months more or less of arguing and negotiation has taken place by the Iraqis, it looks to me like a classic case of obstructionism. Iran, I'm sure, is behind this. Al-Sadr is showing his true face as a petty little puppet of the mullahs across the border.
Obviously, the person doesn't know much about the internal makeup. The Sadrs actually are more independent of the Iranians than Skiri.
Wasn't Sadr doing a lot of study in Iran? In fact,
well, every Shiite cleric does study in Iran, but
he recently spent quite some time.
In
Qom, in the holy city.
Very very much so. But that was presumably more for theological reasons. There is a very, there are certain factions, of course, within the mullahocracy in Iran that has ties to Sadrist, and within the Sadrist movement, you have factions as well. But generally, they are more nationalistic in many respects. They don't want to be controlled, by Iran. They're willing to, make tactical alliances because they are a regional power in many respects. But this is a group that has traditionally taken despite being both Shiites, there's a big difference between Arabs and Persians, historically, culturally, linguistically, in a number of ways, and they're not ready to be anybody's puppet. So I think that's a misreading there. I do think, though, that the certainly Iran is going to try to manipulate things in their favor, and that's one of the many setbacks strategically this invasion has caused, is that they're going to, no matter what happens to the specific agreement, they're going to be a major influence in Iraq for many years to come.
Well, we'll continue to watch and see what occurs and what transpires with this agreement, ongoing infighting in the Iraqi parliament, but it certainly could be in many ways a rather dramatic and decisive move as far as U.S. troops and the future of U.S. troops in Iraq. I want to thank Tom Henderson for being with us, senior fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford and author of American Power After the Berlin Wall, and Stephen Zunis, who is professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco and author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. When we return, we're going to talk about the resignation of Jerry Yang as the CEO of Yahoo, and we'll have a couple guests in studio to talk about that. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And as I said, we decided to split this hour because Yahoo founder Jerry Yang announced his resignation this week as Yahoo CEO following a good deal of criticism that had been leveled at him for the way he handled the proposed Microsoft takeover and the Google partnership. And in this segment, we want to look at perhaps what prompted Jerry Yang stepping down, what it's likely to mean for Yahoo, and, well, the future of Yahoo, really. Joining us here in studio is Kara Swisher. She's co-executive editor of allthingsd.com. It's a website devoted to news, analysis, and opinion on technology, the internet, and the media. Good morning.
Hi.
Also say good morning to Charlene Lee, who's here in studio, founder of Altimeter Group. Is that Altimeter or Altimeter?
Altimeter.
Altimeter, okay. And she's also co-author of a book called Groundswell and is a thought leader on social and emerging technologies. And her blog is called The Altimeter. We welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Glad to have you both here. And Charlene, let me begin with you just to sort of get, an overall picture of what you think happened. We keep reading about, for example, Chris O'Brien, the San Jose Mercury News, says Yang was a visionary, but he wasn't a communicator. That seems to be the bottom line for many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, he had the trust of the group of the employees at Yahoo. But as he was going through the strategy, and it's a pretty coherent strategy, you know, it has good component parts, but it was never really able to articulate what his vision was of how Yahoo was going to rise up from the ashes and really move forward and really inspire not only the employees, but also the investors, the partners, and especially the users to say, why do I stick with Yahoo for the long term? So that communication skill, that leadership skill was really lacking.
So what kind of leader does Yahoo need now, Kara Swisher?
Well, I mean, one thing that you have to say, though, is Zhu Yang inherited a pile of a big mess when he got there. And he was installed rather suddenly, and it was because there was problems before. And so, you know, and he stuck with it, which was admirable in a lot of ways. It's just that perhaps he wasn't quite the right CEO to really cut into the problems at Yahoo, which had been pre-existing condition, I guess.
Founders don't necessarily make CEOs.
Some do. Bill Gates comes to mind rather quickly. Yeah. Many others, Larry and Sergey. Yeah, Jobs. Lots of them do. It's just a question of whether you can articulate your vision well, even though you're much beloved and much liked. Yahoo needs a CEO depending on where it wants to go. If it wants to become a media company, it needs a certain kind of CEO. If it wants to stick more towards technology and search, which is very difficult for it, it needs a different kind of CEO. If it wants to sell itself, it needs a different CEO. And if it wants to do a real turnaround, it needs a different CEO.
So it needs about five CEOs.
Well, no. Well, just one. One good one.
Where does Jerry Yang go now?
He's going to be Chief Yahoo. That was his old job. That was that kooky name that Yahoo has for him. And I think he'll stay on the board and probably be not quite as involved, but involved.
Well, in fact, I mentioned, Charlene Lee, the article by Chris O'Brien. He said they need someone to make Yahoo cool again.
Hey, I think it's a good thing. And at the same time, I think if they take somebody internally, somebody who bleeds purple, it's not going to work because that person will be so indoctrinated in the old way of Yahoo. And I think, Kara, what you were saying, they got to figure out what the direction they want to go in. And more than anything else, if cool is the thing that they need to really, again, strike that new strategy, if it is to carve that independent path to be this good player who can play with everybody with their whole new strategy of being an open company, then cool is an essential part of that. But again, I don't know really what their goal is in terms of a strategy. I would hope that whoever that strategy is, that it's very consistent, again, with the kind of leadership that they're looking for.
Well, they want to have a fight going on for a new portal, really, isn't there?
Well, they're trying to be a portal, but the portal has already been there. They have very loyal users, and they've really stuck with Yahoo through all of this time, even though all these other options are there. So if they want to be a portal, though, it can't be a portal that only has Yahoo content. And so they're trying to be much more open, to pull in lots of different partners. And if you're going to do that, you have to instill faith in your partners that you're going to be there for the long term, that you're going to be strong, you're going to have an advertising solution, you're going to have all these players, all these users who will come in and use your services. So I think cool is not just the coolest new gadgets and things. They have to stay on top of that, but it's a really hard race with very tough competitors in the space.
Well, Kara Swisher, what does this mean for users?
Well, it's not going to change that much. One thing that you have to make clear, I mean, the San Jose Mercury News wishes it made the profits Yahoo does. I mean, it's still an incredibly profitable company. It's the biggest site on the internet for content. It has one of the most email users. They have products that are, you know, far and wide. This is no, you know, dying organism.
It's not going to be like AOL?
No, and AOL's still around, by the way, and it's the second biggest, second or third biggest. So, you know, we're talking about these are high growth companies, and they're just not growing. The problem is the comparison for all these companies has been Google, which is almost impossible to keep up with.
In front of the curve. I mean,
well,
how do you,
including Microsoft can't keep up with Google. I mean, that's why it tried to buy Yahoo. So, I mean, for consumers, you won't see big differences. I think what's happening at Yahoo is this openness, more partners, more socialization inserted into the service. It's not going to become a Facebook, but it is going to have everything's going to be socialized. The email's going to be socialized. The calendar's going to be socialized. The content's going to be socialized so that there's more sharing. Everybody's doing the same thing.
Maybe that was part of the problem with Jerry Yang. He made it sound like it was going to be another Facebook almost, didn't he?
I think he just, they don't want to become, they tried to buy Facebook and it didn't work out. It probably was one of the errors. That was pre-Jerry Yang. That they made. There were several acquisitions they didn't make that they needed to make earlier before he got there. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be changing a lot for users. They do have loyal users. It's an astonishing traffic fire hose that they have. And so the question is, can they take this incredible asset and really turbocharge it for the next era and what's happening coming up?
Let me open the phone lines. I know there are many of you who have some thoughts about Yahoo's future and about Jerry Yang stepping down as CEO, and you may indeed have questions as well, and so it's an excellent opportunity for you to become involved in the program. And in fact, phone lines are available, and they're available now. It's toll-free, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Feel free to join, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. We're talking with Kara Swisher, who's co-executive editor of allthingsd.com. It's a Wall Street Journal website, and it's devoted to news, analysis, and opinion on technology, the internet, and media. And Charlene Lee here in studio is the founder of Altimeter Group and also co-author of Groundswell, Right Winning in a World Transformed by Social Technologies. Well, I guess the real question is, how is Yahoo going to win in this world? But particularly, Kara Swisher, if... because it's got such a strong brand, but mm-hmm. if Microsoft buys its search, where is it?
Well, you know, actually Yahoo is number two in search, and by a lot compared. Microsoft is really a laggard in this space after spending a lot of money. So the reason Microsoft wants to get the search is to at least catch up to Google. But of course, even buying Yahoo doesn't catch it up. I mean, it's half as big or even less. I think that Yahoo's got to decide if it's a technology company. I've never thought it was a technology company. It was a media company that used technology. The first story I did back in the mid-90s about Yahoo was about its surfers who actually inserted things into the system. So that's what a media company does. Google is a totally different kind of thing. It's a technology company. And so I don't necessarily think they need the search part of it. And if they could cut a lot of costs getting rid of it, Jerry was very committed to keeping search. I think it's a muscle game where Microsoft and Google are pounding at each side of Yahoo with a lot of money and aggression. And I think it's really hard to stay in it. And Yahoo can focus on the key things it's good at. Content, amazing. Communications assets, amazing. They own Flickr. They own Delicious.
Yeah, there's the whole multimedia.
Yeah, they have all this stuff, and it works really well. And it's an advertising business. They're also the most dominant company in graphical advertising on the internet. Now, unfortunately, because of the econolypse that's going on, the economic apocalypse, I think it's hard to be in graphical advertising. And so, being the leader in a business that's really getting pummeled is hard. But they still are the leader in that area.
You're mentioning search. I once said on the air, you can use your search engine, and an executive at Yahoo called and said, thank you.
Yeah.
Because people are so used to almost saying automatically, in a Pavlovian way, Google.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? You don't say, I think I'm going to go Yahoo something. It's just, it's never going to happen.
Well,
that race is over, I think, and that's what Yahoo has to accept. And I think they do in a way and don't in another way.
Well, the other race, of course, that's on here is for advertising and, you know, also to buoy up the stocks in this. I never heard that term before, econolypse.
They wish they were booed.
Well, Charlene Lee, it's the same problem that so many are facing as far as, you know, getting the stocks to get some kind of acceleration or get some kind of bounce and everything. But what about advertising? I mean, that's really a major obstacle right now, a formidable one for Yahoo, isn't it?
Right. And again, they went through the huge downturn back in 2000, 2001. And one of the things that they were thinking of at that point was actually taking their advertising engine and outsourcing it and selling it to other people. And that's exactly what they've done with their advertising platform. So they have all these different partners now who are joined at the hip with Yahoo, especially a lot of newspapers who realize that they can't stand that themselves. So you could see as a band of brothers of losers in some ways in the advertising, graphical advertising space. But in many ways, what they have done is they have locked down the content space in terms of advertising. So if you want to go out there and really buy some advertising at scale now, you're going to go walk into Yahoo, be able to buy Yahoo, buy all these other users across newspapers, and they want to sign up all these other newspapers and magazines and other content sites too. They become a powerhouse.
Absolutely.
In this space. And that's such a huge asset because they now have users, they have advertisers, they have users across so much of the internet. And nobody has that kind of asset. Google can't even come close to that. They've been struggling for years trying to get into graphical advertising and cannot break through.
Yeah, they bought DoubleClick, Google did, in order to do that. And AOL has advertising.com. But in terms of really high-quality premium sales of advertising, Yahoo is really it's their greatest strength. And unfortunately, in this economy, it's not necessarily the business that's going to do the best and it's going to get the most impacted. And that's, you know, they've been hit. I always say, like, Jerry Yang is like Job. I mean, I can't imagine one more thing that could happen to him. He's got Carl Icahn on him. He's got Microsoft on him. He's got the economy.
Prefer locusts and boils.
Yeah, so. I know. I think, you know, it's kind of, it's been a bad year.
But they have $6 billion in cash. And that can really
buy them a
lot of time. To be able to weather this downturn.
Could bail out one of the auto industry. Maybe.
Not quite.
They don't need a bailout. Yahoo doesn't. No internet companies need bailouts. Nor would they ask for them.
Let's get our callers in. Roland, you're first up. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Yes, I use Yahoo as my homepage. And aside from all the economics you've been discussing, what I favor about Yahoo, and I hope it would continue, is that their news headline coverage is right on the line of being world view-minded, very much interested in international headlines and relations that I find not available on other portals to the Internet. Is that likely to be diluted out? In any changes?
No. I think one of the things is you get to pick all those things on that site. They've actually changed the homepage a lot recently. They're opening up more, adding more mail in, adding more customization on the homepage, and making it more open so that you can put partners on almost like widgets the way Facebook does in a way. But no, I think they have an amazing news organization there considering they do it with a lot of partners. They have very little original content, but they do have some that's quite good. They don't do reporting internationally.
Right, but they're selection is,
yes,
is,
they're
is
excellent.
Very,
you know,
excellent.
If there's a hurricane, Yahoo puts together an incredible page about where you can go to all the various government agencies, all the news, all the pictures. They're as an aggregator, there's only AOL really does compete in that space very well. Google does it through algorithms, which is, you know, it's very popular, but not very good.
The caller's right. Nobody competes as far as international coverage.
No, but they aggregate well. That's what they do.
Roland, thank you for your call, and we'll get more callers on. We'll go to Steve in Menlo Park. Hi, Steve.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Obviously, video is an area of the marketplace that Google has gone after with the acquisition of YouTube. Do we know what Yahoo's approach will be to video?
Charlene Lee?
Yeah, they've tried a lot of different things, and they've all failed miserably. Partly because they couldn't get at that point get around all the various copyrights, which is what YouTube took on head on, and Google is now handling all the legal aspects. They don't really have a good video strategy that I know of, and they've given that up.
But like Kara said, they do have Flickr.
They do have Flickr, but that's photos.
I know it's photos, but I mean
they really haven't extended that franchise over into the video space.
They have a video sprinkled throughout Yahoo, but you know they almost bought Yahoo. Google stole YouTube out from under them within a number of hours. It's a very interesting story if it gets written. But they were going to buy YouTube. They were in extensive discussions with YouTube. YouTube wanted to sell to them because they thought Terry Semel had really good relations with Hollywood. He was the previous CEO, and they were, as usual, Yahoo took a long time making a decision, which is its major problem, I think. And Google just grabbed it out from under them in literally hours. It was kind of it's an interesting, you know, when the history of Silicon Valley is written.
Well, since you mentioned the history and Terry Semel, talk a little bit about that. I mean, the context of Jerry Yang's ascending and replacing
Semel. The last minute. It was very sudden. At the annual meeting before it happened, days before it happened, Jerry was talking about how he didn't want to have an executive role. And then days later, he was CEO. And Terry said he was going to be there for 5 years, and suddenly he wasn't. And of course, it was all mutual. It was kind of funny. But, you know, he did step up for that job. Terry was a guy from Hollywood. He ran Warner Brothers. He did a very good job at the beginning, was focusing it towards media, and then got all tripped up in the search business competing with Google and didn't move fast enough, didn't have the capabilities to move fast enough because he's not a technologist. And it was the wrong fight to have. I think they were right in going towards media, and they kind of choked, and the rest is history.
Well, there's a lot of pressure from shareholders, too, wasn't there?
I think it was very sexy to compete. I think it was very, you know, Google was sort of setting the world on fire. That's a whole different business, what Google's doing. It's about leads. It's about performance. And, you know, Yahoo should have been there, but they focused everything on that competition. And I think they actually thought they could catch Google, which is, I don't know. It's just, it was a little bit of an unfair game.
Well, if you want to join us in the time remaining here with Kara Swisher and Charlene Lee, it's toll-free 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. And here's Elliot, who sends an email that says, it's another case of the better marketer beating out the better product.
Better marketer being at the Google?
I assume he means Google beating out, or Microsoft and Google beating out Yahoo because they're better marketers and Yahoo has a better product.
They're both good products.
They're both good products. But I think in terms of the marketer, mm-hmm. I think Google definitely has done a much better job marketing themselves. Again, very simple product.
Clear.
Totally staying on message about search, about simplicity. Despite all the pressures and all the things they've added, they've kept that beautiful homepage simplistic.
Right.
And they struggle with it. I mean, that's one of their shortcomings, that they can't break out of that. They're still a one-trick pony.
You know, another irony is that Google started on Yahoo. Google was Yahoo mm-hmm. Search for a long time, and Google, it very similar to what Yahoo did to Netscape, Google did to Yahoo. And it was that's how Google got its marketing strength, was by being search on Yahoo. And I remember at one point when Google.com started to get really big, I think I talked to Jerry or Terry Semel, and I said, you know, you need to get them off of your page, because they built Google's business, and Google owes a lot of its success, early success, to Yahoo.
And we go to Alex next. Alex, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if it was really a matter of communication with respect to Yahoo that led to Jerry Yang's downfall and their current issues, in particular because they've seen them had an inspired technology strategy. But they always seem to have some sort of lack of clarity with respect to business strategy. What would you say about how their business strategy issues factored into their current problems?
Yeah, I think that the business strategy has always been around advertising being driven towards that. And again, I think one of the points that Kara made was that they just are very slow in making decisions, both on the technology side and the business side. So when you buy a great acquisition product like a Right Media to build an advertising foundation on it, to not move quickly and forcefully into integrating that into your host's advertising platform is a mistake.
They did the same thing with Overture, which was an amazing purchase. Google regrets not buying that company. And they were very slow in getting it integrated into Yahoo or doing anything with it. And that put them back a lot of years. I use the term lugubrious when I talk about Yahoo's or collective. It's sort of everyone, they ask everyone how everyone feels almost. And there was a very famous thing called the peanut butter memo, which was written by an executive who's since left Yahoo, about the problems there, that everything was spread too thin and was sticky decision making. And they have not gotten that out of their system. And again, with the Microsoft thing that went slow, the Google deal with the ad deal, too slow, the Carl Icahn, after a while, you really do, even if they're not the best decisions, you have to make a decision and go in a direction. I think Yahoo definitely is a very thinking culture, and they're surrounded by sharks like Google and Microsoft.
Too cerebral, maybe?
I don't know if it's cerebral. It's hard to explain if you don't watch them. They just don't make it's a management problem. Charlene writes about this all the time.
Yeah, and I think one of the things is their culture has been always so collaborative, so purple, mm-hmm. and a very, very strong culture and a wonderful culture. Very smart people. But they can't agree, and everything, because it's done by committee, gets watered down. Yeah. I look at some of their new products, and some of them have great ideas, nuggets of brilliance. But because there's nobody sort of forcing them to say, take a stand on something,
right.
And it's okay to fail, almost, whereas the Google culture is all about trying something, getting out there, failing, and then learning.
See, this is a problem with Bolshevism until Stalin came into power.
I used to call it the attack of the Yahoo vice presidents. I mean, they have like 10 times more vice presidents. It's an interesting it will be an interesting case study in how to manage. But I mean, the question is, can you change a culture like that, or can you, or is it not possible to do that? And again, unfortunately, they're competitors. I mean,
well, certainly
vicious.
The criticism has come to down to leadership, though.
Well, it's also niceness. One of the quotes I used in one of my posts was, Jerry Yang is too nice, and that's his problem. And I was sort of like struck by that. He is an incredibly, I mean, first of all, he's an internet visionary. No matter what you say, I mean, losing all this market share and market valuation has not been a good thing on his record. But he is an internet visionary. He was first. He did astonishing things along with his partner, David Filo. But he is very nice, and I hate to say it, but it is almost a problem because he definitely looks for collaboration. He looks for consensus. And at some point, you
so
just
Leo
have
DeRocher
to...
So Leo DeRocher was right. Nice guys finish
apparently
not necessarily
in
last.
This case,
but,
in this
well,
case.
Well, in this environment, well, against a competitor like Google.
But yeah. We keep hearing about communication, like the caller indicated, that he couldn't communicate well enough to the broader
articulate.
Community. He couldn't communicate to the shareholders, and on it went. I mean, this has been, at least from the perspective of leadership, the major thing that has been... slung at him, so to speak.
Well, it's a lot about that. I mean, look at the presidential campaign. I mean, Barack Obama was very articulate about what he was doing. I mean, it's a lot of about how you say it. We had Jerry and Sue Decker, who's the president of Yahoo, to our conference D, All Things Digital, which I do with Walt Mossberg. And one of the things that was incredibly striking was we kept asking him, why are you the leader of Yahoo and what is Yahoo? Walt Mossberg interviewed them. And they couldn't answer it. It was that's sometimes what you can't do is more striking than what you can do. And they really had a hard time. And I think they would agree that they couldn't answer what Yahoo was and why they were the leaders, the correct leaders for Yahoo. And if you can't answer that question to a crowd of Silicon Valley elite, you've got a problem.
Yeah. Where is Yahoo headed? What's the vision? Give it to me in one sentence. And it was always this long paragraph.
Right.
And you had no idea where you ended up at the end.
Yeah, right. It always sounded like Facebook. David, hi. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Yahoo's been shedding thousands of jobs. And I've actually been thinking about applying for one that's been advertised. Would that be a bad career move?
Well, you know, you're at the bottom. It's always, there's only up, although not necessarily. You can always go to zero. You know what? I think Yahoo, if they get the right CEO, they're in a perfect – they've done it before in 2001. They are a major brand on the internet. This is not going – this company is not going away. Advertisers really do love this company. They do want an alternative. Something is going to happen at Yahoo. It is an advertising company. It has quality advertising compared. So.
I recommend people apply to Yahoo all the time. Yeah. It's a fantastic organization, great culture. Pros and cons of that culture when you're working there. But I think it's a great place to work. It's a really collaborative environment. Again, right. You will learn so much. It'll be a great thing to have your resume. Who knows what the long-term prospects are.
And also, they just hired a new head of ad sales, Joanne Bradford, who came from Microsoft before that, Business Week and Spot Runner. But she's a new leader there who's got a great reputation, too. And I don't know how much she's hiring, but obviously, if advertising is their business, just because there's a downturn doesn't mean you stop hiring, you stop growing.
Well, good luck in your decision, David. Actually, this might help or hurt. I don't know. Here's Karsten, who sends the following email. It's interesting to note that year-to-date, Yahoo edges out Google, at least on stock performance. Both companies are down 55% to 60%, but Yahoo's slide is actually less than Google's. And she goes on to say, that said, Yahoo has lost the edge in innovation, change, excitement, and most significantly, in talent recruitment. Ask any techie which company they'd prefer to work for. I suspect Google wins hands down.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the market share of Google's way down, but and so is the whole stock. It had further to fall because it was up in the $700 range. But in terms of performance, it's not even a question. In terms of margins and growth, and Yahoo has really lagged and gone backwards, and so has many other companies. But Google has grown less, but it was already spectacular growth. So, you know, that's really where people focus on. The stock price is definitely down at Google, but it's the growth. The problem with Yahoo is they're losing growth, and that's the problem.
For anybody who's feeling sorry for Jerry Yang, his net worth is $2.2
billion. Yeah.
35-year-old who dropped out of Stanford. It's about some of these guys who are dropouts. That's a whole other story.
Bill Gates
from Harvard, yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's David, who says, years ago, and it was a toxic snake pit that had horrible distributed management with people scared to make decisions. Lots of young people can't listen or take direction.
Yeah, there's a powerlessness to the power there. You get that from even to I was always struck by top executives as they began leaving. They felt that they had, despite their titles, they felt like they didn't. It wasn't a fear culture. It's not even that. I think that's not correct. I think it's nobody knew where the decisions were being made, and it all funneled up to the top, and that creates. I mean, Charlene can talk.
Well,
about
it funneled
this.
To the top, and then went down and got kind of stuck there. Right. And the people in the middle didn't know what the people at the top wanted, and they were micromanaging down, and it was just a big mess. I mean, when Terry Sumwalt came in, he brought a lot of that organization that was needed after Tim Google left, but then it stagnated. Because once it got sort of busy and organized everybody, that organization just was paralyzing. It was really good for
They have
for
a thing called a matrix. Matrix, yeah. Which means anybody can screw up anybody else, essentially. Right? The engineering can stop the product. People can stop that. And so different companies organize themselves differently. I think there's a lot of complaints about the matrix system there. I don't even understand what it is, frankly.
Here's Amanda who writes, in terms of being bought out, has everyone conveniently forgotten the inflated severance packages Mr. Yang implemented in a vindictive move targeted against Microsoft? Why would Microsoft want to buy the entire company under those punitive conditions? Yahoo employees should be asking Mr. Yang some tough questions.
Yeah, that was bad. That was a bad trick. That was one of the issues with Microsoft, I think, decided not to buy the company when that happened. He put in a severance package that was just, it was incredible. Everybody
was bloated,
got paid.
Really.
Well, no, it wasn't bloated. It was every single employee got paid no matter what if they wanted to leave. It was an astonishing kind of thing. And of course, they made excuses. Oh, they would have done it anyway. But it was, that I think was a real wake-up call for Microsoft to walk away. I think that was a key moment.
We've got a caller from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Lucy, you're on. Good morning.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Hi.
I just got on the last 10, 15 minutes of your program, which I love, by the way. And I, you know, have always liked Google, and I do like Yahoo, and I have stock in Google. But I was wondering, you know, because I noticed a lot of negativism about Google, and I was wondering from, you know, what you all are saying. So I was wondering kind of specifically what are those, if you could kind of just list what are those negativisms about Google that you've been talking about.
Well, you've used words, Kara Swisher, like vicious and shark-like.
They are. They're like, that's not a bad thing necessarily. I've been a little tough on Google. Actually, incredibly, my partner works for Google, but I think they've become a really dominant company. They just had a tangle with the Justice Department again. No matter how any powerful company that has this dominant a market share, they're at 70-80%, Charlene,
yeah.
I think,
mm-hmm.
You cannot – power corrupts, and I think that they really are – advertisers are frightened of them. You know, publishers are. If you don't exist if you don't show up on Google. And so in a very similar situation to Microsoft, they're certainly not as thuggish as Microsoft was in their heyday, but – you know, any powerful company gets 70% of the market, I am wary of. I don't know
Leave
about
it
you.
The power corrupts and 70% power corrupts 70%.
Or more.
Thank you both. Kara Swisher, again, is co-executive editor of allthingsd.com, and Charlene Lee is founder of Altimeter. And we've got another hour for him coming up. We're going to shift in the next hour to the Middle East. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.